This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
Okay, I'd like to welcome everybody to Dog Guide Handlers Australia special presentation tonight. My name is Rowena Dowling. I'm secretary and one of the founding members of DGHA. Tonight we have a presentation from Daniel Kish, and I am very pleased to welcome you, Daniel, and thank you for joining us tonight. Daniel will be talking about his flash sonar or echolocation technique, which is very useful for anybody who's blind or vision impaired, regardless of the mobility aid that you use, so canes or guide dogs. But tonight, as we have a focus on guide dog mobility, Daniel will be talking about how these techniques can be used to help people understand the environment and stay orientated. Daniel has a website, worldaccessfortheblind.org. I think that's right, Daniel?
That is correct.
And I'm sure if you wanted further information or to contact Daniel, you can go to that website for further information. And we have a link to Daniel's website from the resource page on the DGHA website, so you can also get that address from there. So, Daniel, thank you very much for joining us tonight, and we'd like to welcome you, and over to you.
Well, thank you all. Thanks for your interest, and thanks for your supportive words.
Hi, folks. It's Joyce Jones. I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm late.
Thanks, Joyce.
I'm very, very pleased to have been asked to present to this forum. It's been a year in the making. But I'm finally here. I'd like to give a little bit of background because I'm not really sure how much people know about me, and some of what I will say is not necessarily common knowledge. I am 46 years old. I've been blind since I was about 13 months old. I have been using echolocation as a principal means of navigation since I was probably about 15 to 18 months old. So I've been using it for as long as I can remember. About 15 years ago or so, I began developing instructional methodologies for teaching echolocation, which we have retermed flash sonar, given the style, the term flash sonar reflects the style in which we teach and the type of sonar that we teach. We are fully well aware that most blind people do use some form of echolocation. So it's our claim to fame, if we have one, is not that we developed echolocation. It's that we've developed a means of systematically teaching it and teaching it to consistent, reliable results. What isn't perhaps common knowledge is that I myself was a dog guide user. I had a dog guide from the time I was 18 to the time I was about 24, so for about 6 years. and I had the experience, as many do, and when I was done with the experience, I didn't go back. Now, I will also say that for various reasons that I won't go into, when my dog guide died, I came into a situation in which I was able to train another dog, or rather help train another dog, to serve as a guide. So I have some experience both using a dog guide and also training a dog guide who didn't, in the end, go on to be a guide, not because he wasn't able to do so, but because he basically became attached to someone else and we chose to give him to that someone else. Now, since then, I have gone on and acquired certification as an orientation and mobility specialist. So I was certified in the U.S. As an orientation and mobility specialist, and I've been practicing as an orientation and mobility specialist for the past 15 years. In those 15 years, I've had the fortunate opportunity to be privy to a lot of dog guide teams, a lot of dog guide schools in many, many different countries throughout the U.S., Canada, the U.K., the Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland, and other places that aren't coming to mind, including Australia.
Dan, I was going to drop in there if I could, not for a question, but somebody's got their phone on speakerphone and it's feeding back and it's making it very difficult to understand. If somebody could, if they have got their phone on speakerphone, please turn it off or mute your line. Thank you.
Okay. Yep, that's better.
Thanks.
Thank you. So there have been a lot of countries, a lot of experience with guide dog users. I have worked with dog guide users. In the U.S., we call them dog guides as a generic term because not all – some schools in the U.S. are guide dog schools, quote-unquote, and some are not. So in any event, I've had experience working with many dog guide teams, and here in Australia, I've done a lot of work over the past some years with Guide Dogs New South Wales, a bit of work with Guide Dogs Victoria, and so that's sort of the background that I bring into whatever I'm about to say. Now, as a dog guide user myself, let me step back a little bit. Before I became a dog guide user, I mentioned earlier that I used echolocation as a principal means of mobility. From time immemorial, from time before I can remember, I had developed a click, and that click served to provide me with a pretty rich tapestry of information about my environment. And so I was moving around on my own quite well, quite effectively throughout my community, throughout childhood. I went to a regular school. I walked to school. I walked to friends' houses. I walked to the store, to the shops. I walked to many different places, many of which I taught myself. So I learned at a fairly early age how to kind of teach myself how to get around, even in places that were not familiar to me. My falling into getting a dog guide was really, I was tucked into it, is more or less how it happened. So it wasn't really my idea, and I had to be convinced. Now, once I was convinced, of course, I got the dog and fell quite in love with her, and you know, that was a whole sort of era of my life. What I found was that while using the dog, I still remained fairly clued in to my surroundings, somewhat as I had before. Using flash sonar, I could maintain a fair bit of control, if you will, over the dog and control over the situations which I was in. So, for example, moving along, I was able to image things that were around me, trees, poles, bushes, benches, landmarks of any sort, buildings from a distance, etc., etc. So because I was sort of connected to the environment, I was able to maintain a kind of, well, to maintain a definite awareness of the environment as the dog was sort of moving me through it, if you will, to the extent that when it came to new environments or when it came to retraining the dog, so I was at university for, well, an embarrassingly long time, actually, and I was at several different universities. So different university campuses, different schedules. I was able to do most of the orientation and most of the training of the dog myself. It rarely required an instructor to actually come out and do the orientation or do the reorientation. When the instructors came out, it was for other issues that I was having with the dog, but not orientation issues. That I had pretty well sussed, and looking back, of course, I wasn't necessarily self-reflective at the time because I had no aspirations whatsoever at the time of becoming a mobility specialist. But looking back as a mobility specialist and looking back as one who has worked with guide dog teams, teams from schools around many different places, I can recall really, really relying quite heavily on my own sense of echolocation to maintain leadership over our partnership. And so that's one of the things I like to emphasize to people is that this skill, this ability, really goes a long way toward enforcing, if you will, the human's leadership over the situation. Now, in Australia, I have noticed that a lot of the guide dog teams that I have observed, now, most of the ones I've observed, to be honest, have come from New South Wales, so I have less experience with guide dog schools in other places, but certainly the guide dog school in New South Wales, I'm quite impressed with their training techniques and quite impressed with the guide dog teams that I've seen there. So to some degree, some of what I'm saying may be kind of preaching to the choir, but what I often see among guide dog teams is a bit of a struggle for the human, if you will, to maintain leadership over the team. And one of the things I've noticed is that those individuals who develop a strong sense of one's surroundings, through echolocation in this case, have a leg up, if you will, in maintaining that leadership and in maintaining control over the partnership there. So that said, when we work with teams, we do two things. One is we do the training with a cane in hand, and the dog can be healed or the dog can be put somewhere else in the beginning phases of the training so that the individual, the blind individual receiving the training, really has a good and proper sense of directing their own movements through space, experiencing what that is, and experiencing through their own movements how it is to interact with the environment. And then, of course, we bring the dog in and we do an integration of the development of those skills with using the dog. So now the dog has become an adjunct to facilitating movement. But we try to make that a matter of joint effort, if you will, under the direction of the human. Right, with the dog being more seen as a facilitator rather than a director per se. Now, the idea behind, flash sonar. We've coined the term flash sonar. The idea behind flash sonar has to do with really highlighting the environment through echoes. So most humans who use echoes use a form of echolocation that we call passive echolocation, which doesn't necessarily imply passivity on the part of the user. What it's saying is that the individual is relying on sounds already in the environment. So traffic noises, the sounds of other people, air conditioners, or what have you, any sounds that occur in the environment will cast a reflection from the surrounding environment. And that information can be used and can be useful. The other form of echolocation is active echolocation, which simply means that the user is actively seeking echoes from the environment, indeed actively soliciting echoes from the environment. So, and that's the form of echolocation that most animals in nature, to our knowledge, use. So if you look at the king of echolocators, okay, the king of airborne echolocators would be the bat. There are a few other echolocating species. There are two kinds of birds that I know of, and a couple of rodents. But the real big one is the bat. And to our knowledge, the bat echolocates primarily by emitting active signals that go out into the environment, rebound or reflect from surfaces throughout the environment, and return to the bat in flight. And the bat uses that dynamic updating of echoes to guide its movement. And if we watch the bat, and there are people who spend an awful lot of time and money watching bats, through various research, you can observe that the bat is heavily, actively involved in soliciting these echoes and responding to these echoes. The chirps that it emits are highly strategic, and they vary systematically based on situations that the bat is in. So, for example, if a bat is just in flight, kind of flying around, sort of maintaining its orientation, if you will, so maybe it's heading back to its cave, or maybe it's left its cave and it's gone out on a nightly foray, the chirps are lower in pitch and fewer in frequency or repetition rate. So in other words, the repetition rate is lower, the chirps are generally louder, and the bat is seeking information from surfaces that are quite far away from itself. Now, we would call that orientation sonar. But as the bat is approaching some kind of target, any kind of target, it could be an insect, it could be it has to fly through branches, maybe it's chasing something, or maybe it's being chased by something. Now it has to interact with specific targets. It's looking for things, it's searching for things, it's avoiding things, or it's looking to interact with things, maybe it wants to retrieve something. The chirp rate, the repetition rate, becomes higher, it becomes faster. And the volume, generally speaking, reduces. The volume gets lower as the bat is looking to zero in on targets that are not distant surfaces, but more proximal surfaces. Surfaces that are closer to it as it flies. In our work with humans who use active sonar, humans who actually strategically emit signals, our signal is the tongue click, and I will get to that in a moment, we observe that a similar thing happens. So there often is a similar pattern of orientation versus targeting sonar. If there isn't, then we have a tendency to teach it because, frankly, we see that it works. We observe that it works, and we can take a lesson from the bat who's been evolving this over the course of about 50 million years. Now, another thing that the bat does is it scans. So we actually have computer technology that allows us to see the signal that the bat emits as it is in flight. And what we have observed is the bat emits what we might call a sonar beam, and it scans with that beam in much the same way that someone searching for a spotlight would scan with a spotlight, or someone searching with a flashlight might scan with a flashlight. The bat is strategically scanning around its environment while in flight. So, for example, There are some experiments where they have the bat flying around a room, and they have this fine, fine mesh net that's difficult for a bat to detect. I can tell you it would be quite difficult for a human to detect as well, even the best of them. And there's a small aperture in this net, and what the bat must do, well, there are two apertures, and the apertures are divided by some sort of a barrier. And what the bat must do is it must choose, or it must determine which aperture leads to the food. So one aperture does not have food. It's just a boring empty space. And one aperture does have food. It's a mealworm dangling from a something. And the bat has to locate both apertures, determine which aperture has the food, fly through the aperture, and retrieve its food. And this is just one such experiment. There are many. But what we see is the bat strategically locates both apertures by scanning, locates the edge of the correct aperture by scanning, flies through the aperture. Okay, so he locates both edges. He centers himself. He flies through the aperture. He locates the food. And then, of course, the repetition rate increases as he closes in on the target. And then he has his meal. In general, bats don't chirp with their mouths full. So, I'm going into some detail about this because we see many parallels among people who human people, who learn to echolocate and who learn to do it actively, who learn to actively solicit information from their environment. And the scanning is very important. So the head scanning is very important. So when I was using my dog, I always remained very active in soliciting information from my environment. Maybe that's in part because my dog was a little bit flaky. She was a very happy-go-lucky Labrador. And while Labradors are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful dogs, they are not necessarily always the most disciplined. So I was really careful to make sure that I had, that I was able to maintain my awareness to my environment and really maintain my sense of it as I was moving through it. That I was really able to direct, sometimes forcefully, sometimes with deliberate purpose, where the dog was to go. We rarely had occasions of me arguing with the dog about where she was supposed to go. Now, that did happen occasionally, but for the most part, I already knew. And I was already able to kind of, if you will, direct the dog to go where she needed to go. Okay, so that involved tongue clicking in a relatively strategic way, and then, of course, scanning with my head, literally moving my head from left to right, not in a in a really obvious way, but in a manner that really actually looks as if someone is attentive to their environment and engaged by their environment. This is the feedback that we've received from our students who've learned to use active echolocation. The posture tends to increase. It tends to become more erect. It tends to become more erect. The head comes up, and it starts kind of looking around. And the feedback that we get is that they look more poised. They look more confident. Well, they are more confident. And they look like they're more engaged in the environment around them. Now, the tongue click. So why the tongue click? There are a number of reasons for that. My bias toward the tongue click is obvious. It's something I've used since I was, forever. It's something that I have observed that most echolocators who are highly attuned and who use it highly effectively are emitting some kind of sound, and they're emitting a sound that they're really in control of, and it is usually a click of some kind. So the tongue click has the following advantages. It's hands-free, so it doesn't require the use of one or both hands. It's easily directed, so it's sort of it's head-mounted, if you will. So as you turn your head, so you turn the click, you do what the bat does. You beam the sonar beam, you scan with the sonar beam around the environment, and you do so with a simple head turn, and you can do it laterally, left to right, or vertically, you know, up and down. So let's say you're looking for a particular entrance or a particular building, and you happen to know that this building has a certain covering over it, or an awning, or maybe it has an overhanging tree, or what have you. One can be looking for this. I have noted that guide dogs will sometimes not necessarily look up and not necessarily allow clearance for their human partner who stands well above where a dog stands. And yeah, if the dog is really, really clued in and really attentive, then the dog is likely to check where those overhangs might be, okay? I discovered quite early in my training that it really behooved me to maintain my vigilance of my environment because there were situations, for example, situations where we had these archways, concrete archways, and the archway was shaped such that the dog could easily kind of go underneath where the arch arched, and I wouldn't, okay? And when a human skull collides with concrete going at the speeds that these dogs go, the arch wins, okay? When the head bounces, it bounces off the arch. It is not the other way around. So it's just one of those things that I know. And archways are particularly difficult for dogs because I do believe that the arch serves as a bit of a visual distortion to the dog. I suspect that they are relatively difficult for a dog to track. It's a little bit different if you've got a branch poking out horizontally right across your path, which a dog arguably is more likely to notice. But I observed, at least with my own dog, that these arches, she really seemed to have a bit of difficulty with them. And we had lots of them on that particular campus. So I learned to become keenly aware of where those were, okay, and make sure that we were walking at a sufficient distance from the base of the arches. There were a series of them. There were like 13 of them, I believe. And I had to count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, down to 13, or up to 13, and that's where we made our turn. There were other situations where I would only count 3 or 4, and there was another turn into the library or whatever. So I maintained my awareness of how many arches, because the dog wouldn't necessarily know which door, if you will, I wanted to go into. Did I want to go in between the 3rd and 4th archway, or did I want to go in between the, you know, 13th and 14th archway? And, you know, did I want to strike my head on the archway or not? Generally not. So that's what we've found with regard to the tongue click. The other thing about the tongue click is that it's easily adjustable in terms of volume, in terms of amplitude. So what we find and what we teach is that the tongue click can generally be adjusted to suit the environment that you're in, that we're in, and the activity that we're performing. So it's unnecessary and, in fact, not expedient for the click to be sounded loudly, more loudly than it needs to be, or more frequently than it needs to be, because the volume of the click serves as one of the focusing mechanisms of the click. So I mentioned earlier that as a bat closes in on its target, it increases the repetition rate, but it decreases the volume, the amplitude of the click. What it's doing is it's focusing its attention on the near target, and it's reducing feedback from targets that are further away. And one of the ways that sonar does this is by simply reducing the amplitude. So as you reduce the amplitude, you reduce feedback from surfaces that are further away, from, you know, aspects of the environment that are further away, and you increase your attention to surfaces that are closer, surfaces that are the ones you want to know about. So the tongue click is really very scalable that way. It's very easy to adjust the volume of the tongue click. And so what we find is that since individuals can so easily scale the volume of their tongue click to the activity or environment that they're in, it becomes unobtrusive. And it becomes unobtrusive for two reasons. The first reason is that the tongue click need not occur over the noise levels of the surrounding environment, or too much over the noise levels of the surrounding environment. So if you're in a noisy environment, such as perhaps a train station or an indoor shopping center, you might increase the volume of the tongue click to literally cut through the noise around you. But since the noise around you is fairly high, the tongue click really doesn't stand out to passersby above the noise. Likewise, if we're moving through a situation that is relatively quiet, the same thing applies. The tongue click need not be made loudly in a quiet environment, again, depending on the activity. Okay, so, you know, it tends to scale with respect to the noise levels of the environment. Now, this is something that we've observed in terms of noticeability of the tongue click. Blind people do tend to notice the tongue click. Okay, so if you're at a convention or something, and it's a convention of blind people, or maybe you're around other blind people, and you're clicking, such as I do, and I click quite unobtrusively, other blind people will tend to notice. Okay, but what we find, truthfully, is that sighted people tend not to notice. So as likely as it is that a blind person will notice the tongue click, it is equally as unlikely that sighted people notice the tongue click. And I think it's difficult for blind people to imagine that, because we tend to be quite clued in on the sounds around us. And a click is a sound. It's a sound like any other sound. And when someone, you know, walks by, perhaps clicking, if you're blind, you tend to just notice that, and it becomes somewhat second nature to notice that. But it is likewise, in our experience, second nature, if you will, to sighted people not to notice. And I'll give one example of this. I was giving a presentation. It's actually on our website. It's a presentation that I gave to the RNIB. It was a podcast, and there were two interviewers, and one was blind and one was sighted. And at one point, I left the room to retrieve something. They paused the recording, and I left the room to retrieve something. And when I came back into the room, the two interviewers told me a little story. And what basically happened was that after I had left the room and the door had closed, the blind interviewer, who was shall we say, open-mindedly skeptical, okay, of the utility of the echolocation and its social appropriateness. This was in the UK, by the way. It was in London. She commented to her colleague, who was sighted, she said, as he approached the door, I heard him click, but it was much less obtrusive than I expected. Like you could really barely hear it. And her sighted colleague said, I didn't hear anything at all. Okay, he had no idea that I had clicked. And that's what we find. That's what we tend to find over and over again. So I throw that out there just for perspective. Now, in terms of developing the skill, okay, that is something that I have to say, if you're going to do it on your own and you haven't done it already, it requires some commitment. There are materials on our website that some people have used to aid them in developing the skill. I have to warn you that they're not necessarily greatly user-friendly, but we are trying to correct that. It's all a matter of resources. So we travel a lot, visited nearly 30 countries myself and some of my my colleagues who are also blind mobility coaches have visited countries I haven't visited, and we're busy. So what we're attempting to do is we're attempting to compile the resources necessary to organize this material into a fashion that is much more user-friendly, that is a bit more, you know, a bit more do-it-yourself, if you will. But I can say that individuals who really give it some thought and who consciously take time and attention to listen to the environment and listen to echoes from the environment and practice, you know, clicking, or with a dog, you're going to have one hand of, obviously being used, or if you're a cane user, same thing. So either you're going to be tongue clicking or possibly finger snapping, and really, really practice attending to the sounds as they come back. And I would say that in the beginning phases, in our experience, it seems to really help if the learner is in full control over the direction of their travel. So either they drop the harness and heel the dog, that you break out the cane and off you go. And maybe you, you know, have someone around to just kind of eyeball the situation so that nothing, you know, terrible happens if that's a concern. And you practice really developing that skill before kind of bringing the dog in on that skill. I say this from observation. I say this from the instruction that we've provided, because, of course, I already knew how to echolocate when I got my dog. So I don't remember learning to echolocate, and I don't remember learning to echolocate while I had the dog. I echolocated first, and then I got the dog, and it seemed quite natural to me to kind of integrate my use of the dog with the echolocation process. But what we found is it seems to work. For example, when we have group workshops, sometimes we have a number of blind people come in as students, and if they have the dog, they're kind of isolated from the environment. It's difficult for them to verify. It's difficult for them to really clue in by movement, by self-guided movement, in ways that seem necessary to develop the skill. So we do recommend strongly that people, you know, take some time and heal the dog, or, you know, find a place for the dog, and work on developing the skill at first without the dog, and then introducing the dog into the process. It also helps if you find targets or find stimuli that are relatively easy to hear first, relatively easy to echolocate first, such as a building or perhaps an entrance to a building or a large tree maybe or a large vehicle. Or if you have access to a large room, you could practice echolocating a corner. Or you could practice, if you know, many of you can do this already, but if you practice echolocating openings in hallways or door openings, you want to start by hooking your brain into what you're hearing, into the stimulus. We call it the hook stimulus, in fact. So what that basically means is you find the stimulus that really catches your brain's attention so that your brain says, aha, I know what I'm listening for. I know what I'm looking for. And then you gradually move to more subtle stimuli and more complex stimuli. So, for example, you might start with a large building or an entrance to a building that has a nice recess that you can really hear. You know, it sounds kind of cavernous. And you can do a couple of things. You can move yourself further and further away from the building and then practice returning to the building. Or you can look for a stimulus that is less obvious, less apparent. So, for example, a blank wall of a building is likely to be less apparent or less obvious than, say, a large entrance alcove, okay? Or, you know, you have a lot of outdoor cafes here which have these awnings out over the eating area, which can sound quite cavernous, okay? So you might have that, which will sound quite cavernous and will be relatively easy to hear from further away versus a relatively, you know, unadorned wall to the same building or to a nearby building. And then you move to smaller and smaller, more and more subtle stimuli. We have students who can walk very quickly among trees, for example. So they hear the tree trunks or they hear the branches and they just kind of zip in among the tree trunks. They can move through parking lots. They can navigate car park areas on their own without touching any of the cars or anything. Now, if you're a dog guide user, you know, the dog guide will manage those obstacles, will manage those lines of travel. So you may not necessarily be using targeting sonar as often as someone who is not a dog user, okay? Although you will be using it occasionally because it will always have its uses, but you will benefit a lot from the use of orientation sonar, which is the ability to gather information from surfaces and items and environmental features from a distance so that you can maintain your awareness with the dog and maintain leadership over the team. So
Daniel, that just seems like a natural break there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, unless you had something particular that you wanted to raise. I
was just going to open it up.
Ah, lovely, lovely.
Yep.
Two minds.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's open it up for questions. Now, be aware there's 20 people around about online. So we'll try and get everybody. We won't keep us all here all night. So anybody got any questions for Daniel?
Yes, I have.
Vivian, go.
It's Vivian, Daniel. I emailed you last year when you were here in Australia, so I'm very glad that we were able to all be here tonight to hear this. What I was wondering, I'm not a dog guide user myself, and so when you talked earlier about when one is trying to teach oneself or learn the technique, would a cane user have to drop their cane, you know, say leave it somewhere? Is that advisable first off? Or
no, I would not advise you dropping your cane. You'll want your cane with you for lots of reasons. There will be times, however, when you'll want to really kind of choke up on your cane. You'll want to, you know, make your cane shorter. Because for one of our exercises, for example, well, a series of our exercises falls into the category of precision. So moving among obstacles, moving among, for example, parked cars. I mentioned trees earlier. It could be poles. It could be tables. And practicing moving among them by hearing them so that you hear the items and you hear the edges and you hear the relationship between one item and the next. Well, if your cane is fully extended, for an exercise in developing one's hearing, that kind of precludes the hearing portion of it because your cane is kind of, you know, tapping into everything.
Yes.
So in a situation like that, you would choose to shorten your cane and just kind of rely more exclusively on the echolocation, but you're still using your cane even in that sense. So we definitely urge people to continue use of the cane.
All right, thanks for that. The next person with a question, if you could just give us your name and maybe even where you are, what state you're in.
Yes, it's Ramona. May I ask?
Hi, Ramona.
Hi, Daniel. It's Ramona Mandy. I'm from Victoria, and
right.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I really enjoyed it, and I think that's because I related a lot to much of it, or all of it, really.
Great.
And I do practice a fair bit of that anyway.
Great.
I might take the liberty of asking two brief questions. I'm an experienced handler from Guide Dogs Victoria. I've had four dogs, onto my fourth dog, and that school's always been very professional and pushed the point of being the leader of your team as well.
Good.
And having good posture, etc. My first question is, I'm just thinking back when you're talking about walking to your friend's place when you're young, etc. And the things you've talked about in terms of obstacles are buildings, poles, tables, cars. It comes to mind that they're all high things or tall things or large things. And I'm just wondering how you coped without using a cane to detect things at foot level, trip hazards like ridges or tree roots or cords, or if someone's just left a single brick in the middle of a driveway. That's one question, and I might just ask the other question.
Mm-hmm.
We've been taught, certainly at Guide Dogs Victoria, to always be aware that the dog is very sensitive to little movements, and that can be in your favour to help guide the dog, particularly a new dog that's young and needs confidence building. So if you're wanting the dog to go left, besides using the hand signals, even just a vague turn to the left can help the dog clue into what you want, and they can be very sensitive to that sort of movement. How does the impact of your scanning of your head impact on the dog picking up on that?
Oh, that's a very good question. Okay, they're both good questions. The first one is low objects. Yes, they are difficult. They are difficult. And part of our work, I haven't talked about the full breadth of our work, a big part of our work is early, early cane training, early, early introduction. I'm 46 years old. As I mentioned, back in the late 60s, early 70s in the U.S., we were not providing canes or much of mobility training at all to kids. It is like that throughout most of the world still. Australia, the U.S., and perhaps Canada are three countries that I know of that are kind of leading the way, if you will, in getting canes into the hands of young children. We, World Access for the Blind, are leading the way in getting the canes into the hands of even younger children. When I was a kid, I didn't have a cane. It forced me to really have to be very careful, very cautious, of my environment and really pick and choose the environments that I traveled in and develop other strategies. What you'll see with many children who haven't received early cane training is a lot of foot shuffling. This is not just because of lack of confidence, although lack of confidence may well be there. The foot shuffling can and does actually produce reflections from low to the ground that are easier to hear. So the angle of reflection works better for low or ground level objects. The other thing that you'll see a lot of times is you'll see the head quite lowered, okay? For partially sighted children, we call it shoe gazing. So for a child who has residual vision, who has not been taught to use a cane, you will often see their posture stooped a bit and their head lowered, and they're just scrutinizing the ground for dear life. And someone who is an echolocator without a cane may be doing the same thing. Certainly, when I became a cane user, everything became easier. My head came up, my posture became relatively erect, and I moved much more quickly with much more ease and confidence, and that's what we typically see. It's not impossible to detect ground-level objects with echolocation, but if you're using a cane, there's no real need for that because the cane will tend to allow that. And so the echolocation can then be more effective for what it is more useful. So that's the first question. The second question, sure. I didn't notice that my head scanning was a concern to the dog. It may be because as I was trained with the dog, I mean, I was always doing it, right? So you go for 3 or 4 weeks of training. The dog was trained to my manner of movements at the time, right? So it may be that that's one of the reasons it was never really an issue. When I mentioned that I had trained a dog, it was the same issue. The dog, I guess, was just trained out of being much concerned about scanning of the head. But I should say that the scanning of the head isn't necessarily so pronounced or so, dare I say, unnatural that it would necessarily call the dog's attention to it unduly.
Right.
So
I'm
not sure that the dog is particularly concerned about that. But I do relate to what you're saying. I remember when I had my dog, I still had my dog, and we did a harness change because the old harness just kind of wore out, and they switched out the harness and brought a new one. And it took us several days to get used to the feel of the new harness and for the dog to get used to feeling how it was to travel, you know, with me with the new harness. So I've also experienced that sensitive awareness.
Great. Thanks. That's a good explanation.
Okay, next question, somebody?
Yes, me, please.
Yep, go, yeah.
Hi, my name is Ness. I'm ringing from Victoria, and I am a cane user, although I have used a guide dog for about 2 years prior to going back to the cane. My question was, you mentioned that you developed this echolocation ability from when you were a child, and I've noticed a lot of people develop that when they're young. Just wondering, for someone who's an adult or who wants to develop that now, like, what's the, I guess, does it get harder to develop that skill as you grow older, or is it more important to learn it when you're younger? And also, when you do use that skill, like, I know with my own experience, I can detect, say, big objects like trucks and walls, but I would have to be walking slowly to notice that. If I'm walking fast, then I miss it. So just wondering, at what speed do you normally have to walk to, I guess, gather that information?
Okay. Adults, it isn't a problem for an adult to learn. We have many, many students who are adults. We've worked with hundreds and hundreds of students. It's got to be approaching 1,000 blind students, and that's not including families, professionals, etc. Of those, about 25 or 30% have been adults, and adults kind of throughout the lifespan. So what we find is, children do have an advantage in the sense that they're just natural learners, and they haven't learned not to learn. Okay, so they do have a tendency to sort of be sponges and just absorb the process, and they often absorb it very, very quickly. But the key isn't so much the age. The key really seems to be more about motivation and more about, and this is very important, more about opportunity for practice, opportunity for application. So kind of like with any skill, the more we apply, the more we practice, the more refined it becomes. And an adult can really take control over that. They can really set themselves to apply the skill, to practice the skill in their daily lives. With regard to, remind me if you would, the second part of your question.
That speed, thank you.
With regard to speed, I won't say it doesn't matter, because I mean there is a point where the speed becomes high enough that your reaction time isn't there. But in general, no. In general, once the skill really starts to develop and click in, if you will, speed can actually often help. It can often help the perception, because speed may have a tendency to highlight changes in the environment, to highlight any new thing, edges of things, whether things are getting nearer or farther. I discovered this. I mean, research tells us this as well, but I discovered it personally because I was always a pretty fast walker. As a child, as an adult, I tend to move pretty quickly. And I remember when I was student teaching, so I had students as a student teacher. And in order to student teach, I would go into the environment in which I was going to teach, and I'd teach myself the environment. And in so doing, I'd move through the environment quite fast because I had a lot to learn in a short period. Then it came to working with the students, who tended to move much more slowly. And I remember one particular exercise. We were walking parallel to a curb. So it was a ground-level object. It was fairly low, but it was long. So it was hearable, and the student could hear it. The exercise was about, let's learn how to walk parallel to the curb while kind of keeping an equal distance from the curb as we moved. And what was interesting is as we were moving, she was, again, moving quite slowly, and I remember having a bit of trouble determining for myself, what our line of direction was compared to the curb. And it had to do with my own sort of calibration of moving at the speeds that I moved. What we find, actually, in general, is that orientation, particularly acoustic orientation, tends to improve with speed. And I think the reason for that is that any change in the environment tends to get highlighted with speed. Now, that's not true if you're going warp speeds, okay, then everything becomes a blur. But there is a point at which those changes become highlighted, and I would argue that that's somewhere between quote-unquote typical walking speed and, you know, a run or perhaps a slow run.
Okay. Daniel, what's your time availability? You've been going for an hour now. Might just do a quick scan
I have a few more minutes.
Can I get an indication from people around? Just shout out if you've got a question, and I'll see if I can count you all.
Yes, please.
One. Okay. Who was that?
That's Valerie from South Australia.
Go, Valerie.
Yes. My question is, and you might have actually answered this, but I'm just wondering what the difference is. If you were standing still and you were making the clicking noises, would you still get feedback about your surroundings as well? Would that help you if you were stationary and you were making the clicking noises?
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. If you're standing still, it does. You can get information from your surroundings. What will tend to happen is an individual will be standing still. They'll throw out some clicks, and for someone who's really accustomed to soliciting information from their environment in an active way, the head will turn, okay? So you'll start kind of sampling your environment from slightly different directions by head scanning. Then you may find that you begin to move in order to gather more information about the environment. I mean, so for example, one of our exercises, we have a lot of different exercises that serve different purposes, but one of our exercises is to locate a vehicle and determine the front of the vehicle from the back of the vehicle by echolocating. Okay? So you know, without touching the vehicle and without knowing what the vehicle is, you locate the vehicle, and then you find the front, or, well, what you do is you compare both ends, okay, and then you make a determination as to which end is likely to be the front. Now, you can't do that by standing in just one place. The angle is never quite right. In order for the angle to be right to do that, you have to be quite far back from the vehicle. And at the distance you would be from the vehicle in order to get the angle right, you can't resolve enough detail. Okay, so what you would do is from a distance you may say, okay, there is a largish object over there. I bet that's a vehicle. You then approach the vehicle, and you approach the vehicle to a distance at which you now know you could resolve those differences. Maybe it's about a meter, and then you kind of walk along the vehicle to one end. And then you walk, and you kind of click around that end. I mentioned horizontal as well as vertical scanning. So you're going to do both for this. Then you walk around the vehicle again without touching until you come to the other end, and you make a comparison. You make a comparison between the two ends. And without touching the vehicle, you then make essentially what becomes an educated guess at which end is likely to be the front. Okay, and just conceptualizing it in your minds, which end would you say is most likely to be the front? What would be the geometry of the front end of a vehicle, probably, with respect to the back end? You can answer, what would it be?
The front would be more sloped, wouldn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yeah.
The front would likely be more sloped, and what else?
The back would be more blunt, would it? Blunt?
Yeah, the back is often more blunt. The front would often be longer. And what about the height?
Well, yeah, wouldn't that depend on the style of the car?
Yes, of course, of course.
Maybe
you've got... That is true.
You've got to have boy genes to know that.
Yeah. The back is often higher. The back, yeah. is, but not yeah. always. Not always. It does depend. And you can... We have had situations where the two ends were relatively symmetric. Because of the style of the car, of course. So you're kind of dealing with generalities when you know. And so if I choose a vehicle, I choose one for this exercise that can be determined, where the differences are enough that you're likely to be able to make the distinction.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any more questions from anybody before?
Yeah, Rowena.
Yeah, Rowena, please. Go.
I'm in Queensland. I've never heard anyone using the echolocation. I imagine it's not hard at all to click your tongue or click your fingers, whatever you choose to use. But what I'm struggling with is learning how to interpret the sounds that come back. I imagine
right.
it's just a matter of repetition and understanding the sort of sounds that come back from different objects or entrances or whatever you're looking for. So it's a matter of repetition and just learning, okay, that this structure or surface gives back this sort of sound, and if you're looking for an opening or an alcove or a door, it gives you this sort of sound. I'm just wondering how, once you use a technique, that you learn to interpret what it's giving you.
Yeah, it is a matter of practice, if you will. It's a matter of application. It's a matter of checking out and verifying the environment. It's a matter of lots of interactive movement with the environment. It's literally learning to see. I haven't gone into this, but for individuals who are quite experienced echolocators, they are activating the visual system in the brain. So it is the visual system that actually becomes active in this process. It isn't just the auditory system.
Okay.
So you're forging connections between the auditory system and the visual system. And so it is a learning to see that is quite analogous to any sighted child learning to see. And all sighted children do need to learn to see. This is a process that they learn through trial and error, and it involves lots of movement, lots of verification, lots of confirmation, lots of interaction that is self-directed. Now, it may be mediated in some ways by adults who, you know, are there to help the infant and toddler learning these skills not to die in the process. But other than that, it is a self-directed process. And we are, in essence, kind of simulating that process, but we're older. Okay,
yeah.
So you put yourself through a similar analogous process of moving through your environment, confirming what's around you, actively listening, actively seeking information, and this is the important part, I think, belief that this can be done, right? Because many of us, you know, we haven't been told that we can just learn to do this. It's almost a best-kept secret, in a way. We've been told that, yeah, you know, most blind people use some form of echolocation. Many of us may have been told that, oh, yeah, we've all heard of those, you know, those special echolocators. They're special people, you know, who can learn to do this. But really, that's not what we found. I mean, there are certain individuals who may be more talented than others, just as there are individuals who are maybe really good piano players, for example. But that doesn't preclude just about anyone being able to learn to play the piano if they want to. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So even if you don't necessarily learn to play it, I think Carnegie Hall when I say this, that doesn't mean that you can't learn to play the piano quite effectively, quite functionally. And that's just what we find. We just find that most people who want to can learn echolocation and learn to use it and apply it in functional ways to improve day-to-day life.
That's excellent. On average, I mean, I know it would be individual, but how long does it take somebody to learn and become proficient in using it in a practical way, as an adult, I'm meaning?
Yeah, we're talking in terms of days. In terms of instruction, it tends to happen quite fast. Now, as you say, it is individual, okay, so sometimes it can take longer than others. But it can take a matter of days, and then the important thing then is practice. So if I come and I work with someone, or one of our instructors comes and works with someone, they might spend 3, 4, 5 days, depending on, you know, we like to get as much time as we can get, okay? But once that time is over and they have really reached a level of skill that's usually pretty high and usually pretty functional, the next step is to do your homework. You know, the next step is to practice. It's a bit like learning a language. You can go through a 3-week immersion course and learn a lot of language. I speak from experience. You can learn an awful lot in 3 weeks of intensive training. And you can learn to converse, and you can learn to communicate, and you can learn to be quite effective. You're not necessarily going to be teaching a college course in that language, but you can certainly communicate at the community level, at the day-to-day general public level. Then what happens if you go away and you don't use it?
Yeah.
Right? It fades. So it's the same thing here.
Daniel, mm-hmm. It's Nicole in Queensland. I do have a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
The university campus that I study on has a lot of wind distortion. The wind swirls, it howls, there's wind tunnels, like the wind rushes. So much so that a lot of the buildings, actually, after the university was constructed, they came back later to put in cladding to try and disrupt it because you couldn't even hear yourself inside the buildings. It's quite bad. And that's one of the reasons why I ended up getting a dog, because I just found with the cane that even
just trying to listen and trying to use a lot of those normal techniques that I'd been able to use in the past as a cane user didn't work particularly well on this campus because of how disrupted it seemed to be with these wind patterns. So I'm just wondering how using like echolocation with on a campus like that, whether it would likely to get distorted or disrupted?
I think you just have to just get rid of all the wind.
Oh, I would love to, trust me. Yeah. Even with the dog, we get blown along sometimes, I swear.
Absolutely, I know. It's not an ideal environment. It's one of those situations that you really, really have to work to adapt to, and I speak from experience because my second college campus was like that. It was like you described. It was located kind of at the foot of a mountain pass, and so it channeled an awful lot of wind through there to the extent that when we were having high wind days, they brought electric carts to transport people who needed it, people who were concerned about being blown over or blown away, would take these carts. And it would blow over we had these concrete waste bins that were, they must have weighed 30 kilos. And those would get blown over. The wind would come whipping around the corner of a building and just blow these things over. And when I first arrived on that campus, it was difficult. I learned that one can adapt. I learned that scanning really helps a lot in situations like that. You kind of find the head position that minimizes the wind distortion, and you sort of take samples of your environment, if you will, that way. The other thing is that when we teach, we try to teach in somewhat more idealized environments, so the skills have a chance to really develop. In a fertile way. And then, of course, we would move into these more inclement environments where you just really have to work. You really have to cultivate that adaptation to these environments. So it's not ideal what you're describing, but it is manageable, once again, in a functional way. I mean, I wouldn't be riding my bicycle in wind like that. I wouldn't be running any races in wind like that. But I could certainly get around in the kind of wind that you seem to be describing.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, Dan. I'm just noticing there's a few people dropping out. It's getting quite late in the eastern part of Australia.
Sure.
Quite early over here where I am. But unless there's something really pressing with somebody, I'd like to thank you for making your time available. Fantastic, fantastic talk. Very interesting. Very stimulating. We certainly would like to get you back at a later stage. And if people want to get onto Daniel's website and put his name into Google and find it that way, or put your Dog Guide Handlers Australia into your search engine of choice, and on our website you'll find some details where you can find Daniel. So thank you, everybody, for coming along tonight. And thank you to Daniel for making yourself available.
Yes, thanks to
thank
everyone.
You.
Thanks
thank
for
you.
Having
thank
me.
You.
Thank you.
Very,
very
interesting.
Interesting.
Thank you.
Happy traveling.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?